Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. Back in October of 2013, Elder Jeffrey R. Holland gave an important, a paramount talk titled Like a Broken Vessel, where he addressed the stigmas of mental illness and really gave encouragement for not only leaders, but the general membership to consider that these mental illnesses exist in our communities, in our wards, and that we need to maybe do better at addressing them and helping people overcome them and finding happiness and purpose in their life. Now, on this topic, I was encouraged a few weeks ago when I received an email from Kerry Ferguson, who's the author of The OCD Mormon, a new book, which I'd highly recommend leaders check out. She also writes a blog by the same title. And her husband, Jamin, we all sat down for an interview and talked about this important subject of not only obsessive compulsive disorder, but also just mental illness in general, and what a leader needs to consider when calling these individuals maybe to leadership callings or to involving them in the ward in some way so that they don't unintentionally get pushed towards the fringes of the ward. And Kerry's actually serving as Early Society president at the time of this recording, and she talks about that, you know, how to balance mental illness and that she's received treatment for and making great progress, but also taking on an intense calling like being Early Society president. So important discussion. I hope you gain from it. And a lot of important topics discussed here. They also mention a conference that they're putting together in March that I can't recommend enough, that all leaders in the Salt Lake Valley or those that can come to the Salt Lake Valley attend that, and you're going to gain so much from that. Hey, and before we jump into this interview, I want to encourage you, if you're enjoying the content at Leading LDS, to head on over to leadinglds.org and to sign up for our newsletter. If you want to make sure you don't miss any of this valuable content, being on the newsletter is the place to make sure you don't miss that. So go on over to leadinglds.org. And put your email in, and we'd love to make sure that you're part of the community and you're not missing out on any updates. So here's my interview with Kerry and Jamin Ferguson, Kerry being the author of The OCD Mormon. They were headed up north to, at least north from me, to Vancouver, Washington, to talk with Kerry and Jamin Ferguson. How are you two?
We are great. Excited to be here.
Nice. Now, Kerry, the reason we are having this conversation, I believe, if I remember right, you reached out to me or somebody your husband did or whatever it is, but you have recently written a book. Is that right?
I have. It's called The OCD Mormon, Finding Healing and Hope in the Midst of Anxiety. And it's about my experience with obsessive compulsive disorder and being a member of the church and a leader in the church as well during that time.
So how did this book come to be? What did, obviously being an OCD Mormon, maybe this was part of that OCD that you thought, I'll take on a book project. That'd be great.
You know, it's funny. I always wanted to write, and I had this really hard, like, what am I passionate about? What can I write about? And it was kind of this, crisis of what should I do? And then we were living up near Seattle, and I had a miscarriage, and my OCD came on really strong with contamination at that time. And I had dealt with it for, you know, years before then as well, but it was so strong and became really debilitating at that time and led us to make a lot of life choices. We moved down from this island we were living on to near Portland so we could get better care and have more access to care. And I started writing the blog, theocdmormon.com, which I still have. And I don't know, just that fall, I guess, after I finally got treatment and was going to a psychologist and things, I realized I want to write a book about mental illness and being Mormon. Hmm. And so I kind of wrote a general book about mental illness and using a lot of quotes from general authorities. And then I had another Mormon author, Matt Harrison, edit that. And she basically said, no, you need to be telling your story here and that will make it way more powerful. And so I took her advice and wrote my story and incorporated, you know, advice, kind of self-help for those who are dealing with mental illness, specifically OCD or anxiety, as well as tips for loved ones and how you can, you know, live this life with a mental illness in the church. So that's kind of how it came to be, I guess. Long answer.
You know, and before getting this, Jamin, maybe we'll break tradition here is if this is a sacrament meeting talk and in the we have the new couple speaking. What do we need to know about you two before we jump in really heavy into this topic of obsessive compulsive disorder?
Just a little bit about us. Carrie and I have been married for about 9 years now. We met in Seattle. I'm telling you all sorts of random stuff, but it's cool. We met in Seattle in a singles ward some time ago. We both served missions. I've served in Elders Quorum Presidencies and a bishopric. Carrie served in lots of times as presidents and as Relief Society president or as primary president twice. So we have a lot of church experience, but we're very, I don't know, we're pretty, I think we're down to earth and sort of quirky. We've got two young kids.
Not the Peter Priesthood, Molly Mormon type.
I'm among my people. I appreciate this.
Yeah, we're our own ways. We like living in the sort of Portland area because it's a lot of, quirky stuff here, and we really enjoy that. One thing I'll say about mental illness, my mom has bipolar disorder, and so I grew up around some pretty intense at times experiences dealing with mental illness and mental health problems in my family. And so it really trained me when Carrie was going through this to hopefully be more supportive and be more also sort of like able to notice red flags and say like, hey, maybe we should go get help. Whereas right. I think a lot of people really have trouble acknowledging that there's a problem, that they need to get help, that something's wrong. So I think me having personal experience with that growing up has made our relationship much stronger as we've gone through mm-hmm. some really difficult times with Carrie's OCD experience.
And Carrie, you're currently serving as a Relief Society president. Is this your first go at it?
This is my first go as Relief Society president. Like Jamin said, I've been primary president twice and I've been in a young woman's presidency before. But yeah, this is my first go.
Wow.
It's hard work.
It's hard work. It is. It's a different experience for sure.
Now, did the bishop know you were writing a book about obsessive compulsive disorder before he called you? Or
this is an interesting thing. The bishop, before he mentioned to me, kind of asked Jamin, my husband, if I would be able to handle a big calling.
Right.
Based on my OCD, because I was in treatment at the time, going to psychologist, and I was doing really well. I was on medication. And so it was kind of like the upswing from a really low point. And so he asked Jamin, and I guess Jamin said, yeah, probably. Because he called us into the office.
It was interesting. You know, the bishop was, I think, really trying to be thoughtful about, he doesn't want to bring Carrie in and immediately sort of assume she's ready for something. But he did really feel like she, feel inspired to call her to this calling. So he kind of was like, is this going to be okay?
Yeah, I think he kind of wanted to call me for a couple months even and was just felt like I can't do it because
she
of
knew
these
what
issues
she was
that
going
she has.
Through.
But the Lord kept saying, no, this is what we need.
So
I guess.
Finally, yeah. So he talked to me and I was, of course, I think she'll be okay. And I think that there may be something interesting there where you might have a hesitation because someone hasn't known maybe whether it's depression or anxiety or whatever it may be. We might sort of feel like, oh, we don't want to ask them to do hard things. But I don't know, Carrie, in your experience, I think you mm-hmm. sometimes like that challenge. And even though it may be difficult and maybe extra difficult for you, I don't think you've really shied away from doing hard things.
No, I think with at least with anxiety disorders, a lot of times actually doing the thing you're scared of is part of the treatment in a lot of cases, cognitive behavior therapy. So it's good to get out and do the things that make you uncomfortable, even though it is uncomfortable. Yeah. That's kind of the point.
Within reason.
Within reason, for sure. So for me, it helps me to be busy and to do things and to force myself to go to church, or like being primary president and having kind of contamination OCD was difficult because kids are sick all the time, right? Yeah. They're like coughing and they're, and it's like, I'm freaking out. Am I going to get sick? Am I going to get them sick?
Yeah.
So, but just having to do it makes you push through that, at least for me. So when I was Relief Society president and after I wrote the book, I had another bad downturn with my OCD, like really bad. Like I went to the ER at one point with a friend and I stopped taking my medication. And that's kind of, I think what triggered it, And so I felt like maybe I can't do this calling, right? And should I quit the calling? And we had my husband quit his calling so he could support me. And I guess what I've learned there is that, and in praying and, pondering this, is that the Lord calls us specifically for different callings. And we shouldn't expect that we're going to do it the same way as anyone else. But that because of our certain experiences, our personalities, we've been called to serve these people at this time. And it's not going to look like, you know, the last really society president or the last bishop, but we're supposed to do it in our way. And we might not be able to do everything that we think we should do at a certain time. Like there was someone who really needed a visit at that time. And I was just, I couldn't do it. You know, I couldn't go out and visit someone in my state. And so I reached out to another sister in the ward and said, could you go visit this person? And she said, yeah. And, you know, and they had a great like hours long conversation, and it was what that person needed. And it was kind of humbling, you know, to say, okay, you know, it was all right that I wasn't able to physically personally go and make that visit, but it might have been even better. And the Lord knew that.
So,
I think that's important.
So in the book, you mentioned this is your story, and that was a helpful adjustment that you got from an editor saying, you know, no, you got to make this, this is your life, your story, and people will resonate with that. So let's go back a little bit, and just because I want to, I think what we've touched on here as far as, you know, the stigmas that they're out there with mental health, especially with anxiety disorders. And then along with that, you know, Kent, does that just mean we shouldn't call these people the big callings as that, you know, your bishop used? So, and this term OCD, you know, you sort of hear it out there, just people saying, oh, I'm so OCD. Yeah. But this is a real thing. Right. It's not just like a funny way to say that you are very particular about life, right?
Exactly. And that is such a huge thing to recognize. And I think that is why a lot of people who have this disorder don't get the help, or it takes them, you know, over a decade in many cases to get help or to realize that this is what they have, because it's so misused, right? Oh, I'm so OCD. I love to have my house organized, right? I love to clean my kitchen. But it's really this all-encompassing and so often debilitating mental health disorder, where you have this anxiety or these obsessions that make you feel really uncomfortable and really anxious. And then you feel that you must do certain things in order to relieve that anxiety, which is the compulsion, mm-hmm. things you do. And it can range from, some people have cleaning OCD for sure, right? You know, or contamination, where they fear they're going to get AIDS or HIV, or, you know, I have bodily fluid contamination with like going to the bathroom, or other people just have dirt in general contamination and so many different things. Some people have hoarding. Hoarding is an OCD disorder, right? There's also, you know, hit and run, where people think that they've hit someone in their car and they have to go back and check and make sure that they do that, or turning off the stove, or
checking,
like, you know, checking the stove, checking the faucet, checking the door locks,
light switches,
these kind of things. Some people tap the wall because they think if they don't, someone's going to die or be hurt that they love. And so they have to tap or touch certain parts of the floor. So it's this massive disorder that has so many different habits.
And one thing that I think is interesting about it is, if you don't know, you can't peg someone to that they have obsessive compulsive disorder. You're not going to be able to say, oh yeah, that person, they have OCD. I can tell because they're clean, or for this other reason. It's almost, they can be extremely well hidden. And once you recognize mm-hmm. very specific things, you can actually notice that people do certain things. But just as someone that doesn't have experience with it directly, you can almost never tell or guess.
We're really good at hiding it, yeah. I'll say.
Yeah, and I guess that goes...
Because it's like, you know, something's different, yeah. Right? So you hide it.
Because that goes with a lot of things, you know, as far as whether it's a mental health concern or an addiction or whatever. I mean, as human beings, I think we are yeah. very good at just putting a facade on whatever it is of a weakness that we have. Yeah.
Right? Especially at church.
Yes. Yes, right. And hopefully we'll be able to break some of that down and get past that. So, you know, and as you're talking, you know, I'm the dad who's like, did we turn that stove off? Or, you know, I'm not that I'm to that level, but when does it get to that level? Like, how can you say like, wow, I really think, because even my wife, like we have, oh, somebody's coming over and like, she's like in the corner scrubbing tile. And I'm like, dear, like, listen, like they're coming over. I doubt they're going to see that tile is a little bit shaded. Right? And so I sometimes we're like, just relax. Like, so how do we know when, whether in our personal life or those around us are to this point where it's a serious concern that maybe needs professional attention?
Right. Now that's a huge, that's a great question. I think, and kind of the key that even like the anxiety in the Depression Association of America and everything says, is if it is starting to interfere with your life and taking a lot of time and energy and emotion from you, where you cannot, you know, live the life that you want or that you have been living, that's really when you need to say, okay, this is an issue and I need to get help for it. For me, you know, I was able to live with it for years, thinking, not really knowing or understanding what was wrong, but just I could manage it, you know. But when it became like I had to wash my hand, I was washing my hands 50 plus times a day, and I couldn't sit on certain parts of the couch in my mind because I
hug the kids.
You know, I couldn't hug my children, or I couldn't read them stories or color with them because I was afraid their crayons were contaminated. That's when I realized, okay, this is restricting me from living my life and being a mom and being in church and things. And I have to get it taken care of because it's not fair to me or my family.
What about you, Jamin? How did you start noticing it, or was it a surprise that she had these concerns?
I mean, yes, I knew from shortly after we were married that she had some kind of anxiety issue. And, you know, she knew that as well and had been on some medication even as we originally got married, but it was something that I sort of watched over time and how it kind of changed when we lived in San Jose. And this is written a lot in the book. She had a lot of what she mentioned, the hit and run OCD. So it was very, you know, there's a lot of traffic. It's very busy in the Bay Area. And so, you know, she'd come home from the store and it was always like, I think I might've hit someone. There was some noise in the car. Do you think, you know, can you check for scratches? When we walked by cars, it was always going back, checking. I think we scratched that car with a bag. Should we leave a note? Just constant worries. And so it was, you know, we'd have some discussions like, hey, you know, what if you see like a therapist? Wouldn't that be a good idea?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's difficult.
I think for family members and spouses, if you notice someone, or even at church, bishops too, if you notice someone seeking what we call in therapy reassurance for behaviors or things they've done in the past or currently, like constantly seeking this reassurance, like, did I repent enough, or is this okay? Or like me, like, did the car get scratched? Can you go check?
Checking it over and over again.
Over and over again, despite being told once, like, no, you're okay, you've repented enough. If they keep coming back on the same issue or similar issues, that is a good, I would say, warning sign that maybe there's something that they should look into.
the key is going to be like, how do you address that with someone? So, you know, even in Carrie's leadership responsibility in Relief Society, sometimes sisters come to her and she starts to think, you know, maybe they really need help beyond, you know, spiritual help. They really need help. But it's very difficult to say to someone, hey, have you thought about talking to a therapist about some of these issues? Because people do take quite a bit of offense to that. There's also a lot of stigmas around mental health. So people say, well, I talked to a therapist, but I'm not mentally ill. I don't have mental health problems. And so people get it's a very tricky road, you know, whether you're a leader or whether you're, you know, a spouse, of addressing this with people. So yeah, I noticed things for years, and I did my best to sort of encourage her. It really wasn't until, like she said, she really hit sort of this really low point where finally I was able to say, hey, I'm going to make an appointment for you with someone that can help you. Please, will you come? And she agreed. And that was a huge turning point for her.
And so going back, you know, just to create some understanding, because again, I have no reference point for it. And I think many leaders don't either, as far as other than sort of the caricaturized, you know, in movies and things when you see OCD. And my mind just went to what about Bob? You know, the Bill Murray.
So
fantastic.
Anyways, a very stressful movie as well. But that's a whole nother podcast, which I'm not qualified to do. But you know, going back to the example of my wife, if it's one thing for her to be, you know, really, it's important for her to have a clean house, especially when visitors come. But when she is seeking, whether my reassurance or constantly saying, oh, well, I don't know, the house maybe isn't clean enough, or, you know, when they keep bringing those up, that reassurance you talk about, that's sort of when, like, well, this is, we're sort of past the rationale of what a normal conversation.
Right. Or if she's, you know, if someone is cleaning and waking up in the middle of the night, worried about, is my house clean enough? And they're going and cleaning at weird times or multiple times thinking they didn't do it properly. These are the kind of, the OCD will convince you, didn't do it enough. You gotta keep going.
Yeah, maybe missing work or...
Missing work, being things. Late because you're checking your stove. You start driving to work and you have to go back and check it because you weren't sure.
What a lot of people end up doing is it called coping mechanism?
Yeah.
Essentially, you start insulating yourself from things. So when Kara is having the hit and run OCD, where she was worried about hitting cars and constantly checking that, she just had me do the shopping. Or we started using, when we lived in the Bay Area, we started having Google deliver all our groceries, which was really convenient, but
you start avoiding.
You're just avoiding. I mean, we had almost no company or if we'd ever make, because of fears about getting other people sick, if we'd ever have an appointment out with friends, you know, Carrie would last minute say, I think I feel sick, I can't make it. And that was sort of her way of saying, you know, so I'd end up, you know, probably five or six different times out with a group of friends. And it's just like, Mio, sorry, Carrie's not well. She couldn't make it out here. So she ended up avoiding a lot of these basic things. And it was sort of like, you know, to her, she's like, well, it's not a problem. I'm just feeling sick. Cause she was, you know, she'd really convinced herself that she may have been having the flu or something like this because she was so worried about hurting other people. So the OCD really magnifies these little things and makes them these huge worries in your life. And to the point where people start avoiding stuff.
Well, Kara, let me ask you, when Jamin came to you and said, you know, I think we maybe need to involve professional counseling.
Yeah.
You know, how did you respond to that?
It was like, I knew that I did because like I said, I couldn't live my life anymore the way I wanted to, but it was terrifying for me. And I was so emotionally distraught about it and about like, how can I see a therapist and like think that I'm self-sufficient and that I'm, how can I hold a calling? And then I need help from someone else. You know, it was this very like, you're not good enough to take care of your own life feeling. I felt like I was a failure at my life. But at the same time, I knew that I had to get that help or else I couldn't live my life at all. So he, like he said, he made the call. He did a lot of the research and
lots of prayers to find the right doctor. I mean, it's a hard process getting the right kind of help.
Yeah. And so I went. I wasn't really super excited to go, but I knew that I had to do it.
Is it typical for the, I don't want to say solution, but for the treatment to be, you know, a prescription of some type, or is it mainly just a one-to-one therapy that's helpful?
That's a really great question. And, you know, like Jamin said, I was on medication for a while, like when we first got married and when I was on my mission, and then I went off medication and I wasn't doing, you know, psychologists. I wasn't going to psychologists or doing therapy at that time. And then the OCD and anxiety got much worse. And, you know, for some people, it is therapy is enough and they're able to work through with the psychologist and doing behavioral therapy and addressing those anxiety and OCD concerns with that. Other people like me, for some reason, I combine the medication and therapy because the medication kind of takes the edge off the anxiety so that I can do, we do exposure response prevention where we kind of expose ourselves to the worry and then you try and prevent doing the compulsion and just sit in the anxiety. And so for me, like the medication helps me to be able to do that and to not be freaked out so much by the worries and the concerns, the obsessions that are happening. So I would say for sure, I mean, a lot of people obviously will just want to do the medication because it's easy, right? It's like, it's easy to take a pill.
Yeah.
But for me, I think it's so important that you involve this therapy aspect to learn how to change your behavior and to learn to understand why it's important to change your behavior versus just trying to mask it, you know, try and mask our thoughts, but that doesn't really solve the problem. And you can't solve, unfortunately, or cure mental illness. You learn to manage it. And I think therapy helps you to manage it and to be accountable for your behavior to someone else and to want to make changes.
Yeah. It gives you skills so that if, you know, let's say at a future point, you're not able to take medication, maybe during pregnancy or just other life events where it's just not an option anymore. Gives you skills to continue that. Also, one thing she found with OCD in her life, and I assume, you know, this may be true for other mental health issues as well, is that it sort of changes the subject of the OCD. So for a while, OCD was focused on religious devotion and being, you know, perfect. Then it switches to contamination. And so you really develop with the therapy, especially the right kind of treatment and the right kind of therapy, you develop skills to deal with even as the subject of the obsession changes or, you know, what it is that your anxiety focuses on may change. You're able to address those different things. So I think the, you know, my experience with knowing Carrie and, you know, is that when she was just on medication, you know, she really didn't understand how to fight back against these obsessions and these thoughts that were coming to her mind.
Mm-hmm. Carrie, as far as your, with your treatment, what did your treatment look like? You mentioned these three areas, right? Exposure and.
Right, exactly. So for treatment, you know, I went to a psychologist. I found help resources on the International OCD Foundation website because the kind of the recommended treatment is cognitive behavior therapy versus just like talking and trying to find out like what in your past caused this problem, which is kind of what I thought therapy would be like, I guess. Uh-huh. But it's very like, okay, you have this issue. We're going to work with it head on. And they didn't really care what happened in my past or want to talk about that. They want to say, okay, what are the thoughts you're having now? And what are the things you're doing? And we just need to upset this pattern that you're in because it is the catch-22 basically. And it's, you know, doing the compulsions is making it worse, not better. And so they kind of explained, you know, how OCD works, the cycle that you go through and you do the compulsions and you expect that it will make you feel better, but it doesn't. And so you just still have the anxiety and keep doing the compulsions and you just go around and around in the circle until it controls you and steals your life away, basically. So for me and that therapy, what it looks like is they have you many times write down the things you're scared of, the obsessions, and kind of list how scared you are of doing them. It's called a hierarchy, exposure hierarchy. And then they want to work with you to conquer those. And so they say, okay, today, you know, like for me, it was, okay, measure how many times you've been washing your hands every day. And I did, and it was probably above 50. And then they said, okay, we're going to cut that down to 20 a day. And so, you know, suddenly I had to be accountable and say, okay, I'm going to mark down every time I wash my hands. And I'm going to think about why I'm washing my hands and, you know, even combining certain things so that I don't wash my, you know, I'll do this before I do this so that I only have to wash my hands one time instead of two.
Yeah.
But it's these active behavioral changes that they wanted me to make, or go to the bathroom, use the public toilet out. You know, really, which is really hard at certain times, right?
Or go to the worst gas station in town, and then
exactly. This is but what
it retrains
like.
Your brain, right? So that you're not like terrified of every little thing. So they'd have her drive down like narrow streets that you could find, right? And don't ever look back to see if you hit someone. I mean, obviously, if you did hit someone, that's another story. Right. But you know, just drive down the most narrow streets you can find.
And don't go back and check.
And don't go back and check. And, you know, all these sorts of things. And so it's again, it's like retraining your brain so that you realize like, hey, I can do this and I can work through this. I guess one of the things that's interesting though, is it sounds like you're just saying, well, just do the hard thing. It's fine. And it's a lot more nuanced than that. So, you know, when family members often say, well, just get over it, you know, snap out of it, come on, just do this hard thing. And oftentimes the fear is so real that you can't do that. And so with the hierarchies, what they do is they basically, you sort of do it gradually. You figure out what we can do. And once we accomplish that, then we can do something a little bit harder. So there's really a method to it. And it, you know, it really needs to be done with proper help from a medical professional. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, bishops or other helpful people, you know, even people like Carrie that have familiarity with the process really aren't the people that can give that help. They really need to see a trained professional.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. And just hearing this perspective, I mean, it's really helpful to see, you know, how it's manifested in somebody's life. And I can see how that can be debilitating or, you know, very difficult to live your life like that. And I'm hearing a lot of parallels even to like, you know, depression, where a lot of people will say, oh, just come on, you know, get out of bed and just get out and get on with your day. And you'll be happy, right? And it's much more than that. And that's
choose to be happy. Like, I wish, right?
During this time, what role did your bishop or church leadership, Relief Society president play? Did they have any, not that they, you know, that you need to involve them, but did you find that helpful or did you reach out to those spiritual leaders?
This is a great question. So when I first started having OCD problems, I was finishing up BYU and I was in Seattle doing an internship, and I had, like Jamin said, the scrupulosity concerns. And so, yes, I didn't know what was going on. And so I went to my bishop because who do you go to? You know, I don't have family around. I don't have any friends there really. And so I went and I tried to tell him, you know, these are all the sins that I have and what, you know, that things I've done wrong. And he just, trying to find that answer, trying to find him, you know.
And of course, these supposed sins are like, I listened to a mix CD that maybe, you know, was unauthorized. Or,
I burned CDs in college, you know, anyway.
Or I had a friend that maybe did something wrong once, you know, or sped, you know.
And I didn't turn him in or something. Yeah. So, and he just basically said, like, do the best you can, which with somebody who has scrupulosity OCD is basically awful thing to say,
like a death sentence,
because you're like, I should be able to do everything right myself. You know, like you said, the atonement doesn't apply to me. I have to do everything myself because my brain is telling me I can and should. So I did. Yeah, I did go to the bishop there, and it was really hard because I just felt like, oh my gosh, do everything. Like, I have to write the American, you know, the Recording Industry of America and tell them I burn CDs, and I have to contact this person and tell them I watched a movie and I wasn't at the rights, and, you know, all of these ridiculous things looking back.
And no fault to that bishop. It was, but
no, not at all. Right, he was doing the best he could.
Yeah.
And he didn't understand that I didn't understand I had this problem. My parents didn't. No one understood, right? Yeah. So then after we were married, and we lived in California, we went to the bishop again because I was having what I considered anger problems, where really it was probably my children, who were very young at the time, were doing things and kind of going against what my OCD wanted cleanliness wise or in the house, you know, and I was getting angry at them for making messes or doing, you know, doing these various
doing
things,
kid stuff,
doing yeah. kid stuff, which is normal. But in my anxiety, it really heightened that. And so we went to the bishop, my husband and I, and we told him, you know, like, I think I have anger problems. Can I go see, can you give me a recommendation so I can go see LDS Family Services? And that bishop, no fault to him, I mean, we were friends with him and everything. He basically said, you don't have any problem. You're totally normal. You're just fine. Like, we all have anger problems with our kids. Like, this is a normal thing. And then he later called me, you know, to be primary president right after that. And so,
if you have problems getting angry at your own children, let's
yeah,
let you on the whole board.
Let you on the whole board. So, and no fault to him either. Yeah. You know, he did give me a number for LDS Family Services, which never worked out timing wise and appointment wise with them.
But here's something interesting yeah. that I want to point out, because I was in that meeting and I remember kind of looking at Carrie like, Carrie, it's not just about anger. You know, I knew about the other things and just the hyper responsibility and feeling, you know, guilty about so many things. I thought, you know, let's tell them about the whole bit. You know,
but
can
I
you
wasn't,
tell me why you weren't really ready to talk
I wasn't
about
ready
the,
to talk about, you know, everything. I kind of felt like, well, anger is something that, you know, I shouldn't be, you know, in the gospel, right? We shouldn't be angry. We should be patient. So I'm going to talk to that with the bishop. He doesn't need to know about all these other anxieties that I have that are just kind of, you know.
Which I could kind of, as her husband, kind of tell we're all part of the bigger picture here. But it was this thing where I was like, I don't want to like sell her out to the bishop, you know, like yeah. be like, yeah, but she's also having these problems, you know? So we sort of left it at that. But it felt in a way like a missed opportunity, because we were there at the bishop. You know, he doesn't have mental health care experience. So he yeah. didn't have, you know, yeah. insights. And not like he was able to
spiritually discern that I
exactly
had
what was
illness,
wrong. So
right?
it ended up, you know, feeling, you know, we left sort of frustrated, like, well, he didn't really believe us. It's like, well, we didn't also tell him, you know, everything that was going on. So
yeah. Yeah. And I think that's important to just recognize, is that, because what you're articulating here is that, yeah, you went to your bishop, you know, for some help, but not that, you know, you were expecting him to say something that would fix everything, but you right. just didn't. I think it's okay to say you didn't find that it was helpful, but you know, that bishop right. was encouraging and doing his best, but that was just maybe a step along the path of your journey. And, you know, we like to romanticize yeah. about, I went to the bishop and he shared the scripture and then it all became clear. Right. I knew what to do.
He gave me a blessing and I was healed miraculously. Yeah.
And that's okay. Right. That stuff happens. So.
That does happen. That's awesome. But not in this
yeah.
case.
Yeah. And I think that's something that's so important to remember and to talk about and to think about, is that a lot of times people, when they have mental illnesses, the first person they think of will be the bishop, because yeah. the bishop is like my leader. And a lot of times they think it's like a spiritual problem.
Mental and spiritual are so tied yeah. together, yeah. right? Yeah. And those feelings of guilt, you know, are they because I'm sinning,
am I really,
or
yeah.
just because, you know, sinning. Is it your anxiety or something else putting those ideas in your head?
So I think people will often go to the bishop first and say, okay, I'm really depressed, or even like I'm suicidal, you know, these kind of really intense mental health problems. The bishop is often the first person they go to, and it's a huge responsibility for the bishop. And I think that they try to do the best they can, but I, you know, it's so important that they, number one, don't try and diagnose the person yeah. right there, like we were talking about, because that can be really sensitive, and that they really consider, you know, the help that they refer them to. I think a lot of times they think, oh, I'll just refer them to LDS Family Services and that'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's like what they're instructed to do. I'm not sure. I've never been a bishop, but you know, LDS Family Services is great for like general counseling, I think, and for, you know, family relationships, but for really specific mental illnesses, I've heard, and I hope that they are referring those out to proper psychologists who have that direct experience, because if you go to the wrong type of psychologist or counselor, you can be misdiagnosed. In my book, I write about someone I knew in a group who wasn't Mormon, but he went to a religious counselor and they basically, he had intrusive thoughts, like sexual intrusive thoughts, which is also an OCD. And they basically told him he had sex addiction. Mm. And so he left feeling like really awful about himself, right? And just terrible, when really it was OCD and he could get treatment. And if he had gone to the right, you know, source or been referred to the right source in the first wow. place, he didn't have to go through this intense guilt of saying that yeah. he was a sex addict.
Yeah, and I think that's helpful to get your perspective on that, because I think it's good to recognize that, one, we don't expect, you know, people in your situation, they don't expect necessarily the bishop to have all the answers, but a lot of times that's their first contact of actually like bringing this up, right? Yeah. And so what a great opportunity that leader has to say, first, like, kind of do their best to remove the stigma and say, you know, that's fine. Let's see what we can do here. Maybe LDS Family Services would be an option. Maybe, you know, we can find somebody that has heard some of these things more specifically. But, you know, I'm here to help and just sort of take that position of I'm here to help and let's figure this out together.
I'm here to help. If it's hard on your calling, if you need to take a break, like, of course, like, mental illness is not a sin. It's not anything spiritual that you did wrong. Yeah, exactly. It's not your fault that you have this problem. I think that's the kind of counsel that needs to come from the leaders, not like the stigma, you know. Instead, it's kind of like this mysterious, you know, like the, when I was first released site president, like, oh, this lady, like, she's got some mental health problems. Like, ooh, watch out.
Yeah,
you know,
everyone in the ward, especially after Carrie was got very vocal and we did like a fifth Sunday lesson about mental health and stuff. We had like, you know, all these people coming up to Carrie, kind of looking her right in the eye. Are you okay?
Even still, you know, like
so
yesterday
intensely.
At church, you know?
Yeah, we're doing okay. You know, we're doing okay. We're not like, you know, Carrie's not on her deathbed here. You know, this is a problem we deal with every day. Some people might have, you know, a problem walking, and that's something they deal with every day. They don't need this intense, you know, kind of
like, how are you doing?
Yeah. We appreciate the concern and the love, but also, you know, just treat us like normal people. You know, we have problems, but so does everyone else.
Yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about, you know, as far as your experience with that bishop, and again, we're not here to throw anybody on the bus, and it sounds like you loved that man dearly and others that you interacted with. So if you were sitting down with a bishop, a new bishop, and this situation may be in their ward, what do you want the bishop to say in those instances?
Right, that's a really good question. I think for a bishop, it's so important to just listen to the person and their concerns. And then if you realize or you kind of have the feeling that this is a mental illness or a mental health concern, don't try to solve the problem. Don't try to think that you can just tell them to pray it away or read their scriptures more and they'll be blessed and all of this. You can, of course, encourage them to continue their church habits, but don't say that those are going to solve their mental health problem, because mental health and spiritual health are distinct and different, though overlapping sometimes. And I think it's important for bishops to maybe in that circumstance say, hey, based on what you're telling me, this sounds like something that would be great to discuss with a mental health professional. Have you ever thought about going to see a counselor or a psychologist? If you need help researching possibilities, I'd love to help you with that. Or, you know,
or recommend someone. Hook you up with those right connections.
Right, exactly. Rather than just feeling like you have to, as a bishop or a church leader, solve their problem, because that's not your job. Yeah. And in a lot of cases, it can cause more problems
confusion.
Then they think, well, if I can't pray this away, I must not be righteous enough, when that's not the case.
You know, a lot of people have come, Carrie set up online groups for people dealing with some of these issues. And a number of people have said things like, you know, talk to the bishop. The bishop, you know, really was giving them spiritual answers. But like Carrie said, the spiritual and mental health are separate. And so even if you're having great spiritual practices because of your mental health challenges, you know, you're not going to see the results, not going to solve that mental set of problems. And so, you know, getting the right kind of care and help is essential. And of course, you know, bishops, I think the listening part is essential. You know, when what I think could have been helpful in our case when Carrie went to the bishop is a little bit more listening instead of, you know, we got, I think you're fine. And it's like, well, thank you that, you know,
that I can hide it so well.
Carrie's hiding it really well. But, you know, really, especially, you know, she came in and said, I have this concern. Do your best to empathize and try to really see where we're coming from and or where the person's coming from. And then hopefully, you know, drive them the right way.
And there's such a stigma with when it comes to mental health, right? I mean, that can say that enough, really. And so, you know, as I'm thinking of sitting in that bishop chair saying that, like, you know, recommending therapy, which I've done before, nonetheless, I sort of do it as softly as I can because I feel like you're saying, well, it looks like you're broken. So let's talk to a professional, right? So how do we get past that stigma? And for you, what when you heard those words, or how did you get to a point where you thought, you know what, I think I may need counseling and that's okay?
Yeah, I mean, it was just, like I said, just where I couldn't live my life. And I was like, I can't solve this problem on my own. So I have to look outside or else I just have to be a recluse, you know, like not be able to take care of my children anymore.
Yeah, but we'd hope that people didn't have to wait until they hit rock bottom.
Exactly. Hopefully no one else, you know, has to get to that point. I think, like you said, that stigma is so strong and that we need to be talking about this just more casually than we are. it needs to be just a topic of conversation that we're not afraid to talk about. Like we said, we did a fifth Sunday lesson about mental health and the gospel. And even just after that, I mean, the next couple of talks, I feel like in sacrament meeting, people are talking about different mental illness and issues that they've been through. I mean, we had someone talk about how they, you know, tried to commit suicide, and that was kind of what led them to come back to church. And, you know, it was interesting how just being open about it, even just us giving that lesson, encouraged that conversation and that dialogue in our ward. And I think as more people are open about it, and as we don't dance around it and, you know, not talk about it, that people will be able to say, oh, okay. You know, and for me being the Relief Society president and saying, you know, look, I have obsessive compulsive disorder and this has been a big challenge in my life. That gave a lot of women the confidence and courage to talk to me about their mental illnesses or email me if they couldn't physically talk to me about, you know, their problems with suicide or, you know, different really big issues that until I was open, they did not feel comfortable talking to me about it. But they could trust me once they knew that I had that experience. So I think as more people are open, it kind of naturally decreases the stigma. Yeah. And it's going to have to be ward by ward or Relief Society by Relief Society. It's just, it's really difficult.
Yeah. And I just think of that bishop who, or leader, Relief Society president, whoever it is, that think is listening to this and saying, yeah, you know, I want to be that leader that creates a culture where we can talk about this more and minimize the stigma behind it. But what is that like? What should they do? Should they go to people that they know are experiencing mental illness and say, hey, will you talk about it more? Well, yeah. Should they talk about it more? Or what do you think?
I mean, it's really hard. I think it's hard, especially if you don't suffer from a mental illness, to be like, you can trust me because I want you to, you know?
Yeah. That's what it feels like a lot.
Right. Where when I, you know, this, I was a new Relief Society president. And so I went to a lot of people and we were pretty new in the ward. And so it was a good a time for me to say, hey, I don't really know you. Here's my story. And even people, I would say, you know, tell me a little bit about yourself. Like the one woman who the bishop's like, she's got some mental health problems. So I knew going into it that there was something there, but I didn't know what. And so I was just like, tell me your story. And she was very guarded still. And then I was like, well, let me tell you a little bit about myself. And I told her my story. And then she, turns out she had OCD as well and was able to be like, whoa, you understand. Like, ah, this is amazing. So, but for those who don't have a mental illness, it's really tricky. I think the church needs to be so much more open about this. I mean, even President George Albert Smith had mental illness problems where when he was an apostle, he had to take off a couple of years, I believe, to just kind of, you know, get his life back and figure it out a little bit more. And it makes me so sad that we don't talk about these examples that we have in our own church history, because I think it could be so helpful for people to say, wow, an apostle even had a mental illness.
And probably many others.
And probably so many other leaders and church leaders, but we don't talk about it. So even in discussions, I think being aware and discussing it.
I think sacrament meetings, fifth Sunday lessons, this is a huge problem. I mean, you know, recent things I've read about anxiety, so, you know, 1 in 4, 1 in 3 people deal with heavy anxiety, obviously maybe not completely debilitating, but serious anxiety. And so bringing it just as part of regular discussions in ward councils, asking people to brush onto these things as well in sacrament and talks. Just having that, like, one person kind of can open a great discussion in a ward, or, you know, if it's a stake level at the stake, and get people feeling comfortable sharing these personal issues. And another thing that brings out is just the sense of connection with people, because you see that people are imperfect. They've gone through the same struggles. And so whether it's a leader, whether it's another member in a quorum or the group, you feel, I don't know, just a special connection. And I think it really opens a lot of doors.
Yeah. And if people, I mean, not all people are as open as I've learned to be with mental illness, right? A lot of people do not want to talk about it or feel very uncomfortable about it. And so in that case, I think bringing it up, like, let's talk about like loved ones or family members or friends who deal with this, and how do you help them, and what kind of experiences have they had? So kind of like distancing it a little bit from people makes them more willing to be open, like, well, my son or well, my daughter, someone who's not directly in this room right now. And they, that kind of can open the discussion.
Yeah. Too. Let's not say, okay, raise your hand if you're mentally ill,
right.
You know, that would make a lot of people uncomfortable. Right. There are definitely ways to address it in good ways. Another thing I'll just briefly add, you know, I know with Carrie, when she's counseled and shared with people, again, they do feel very uncomfortable if you suggest, hey, would you go and get additional help? Or have you talked about getting additional help? Or, you know, because people really don't want to be put in that box. And so I think the best thing that we can do is just be open about our problems you know, encourage people to share their own problems, and then it'll ultimately make more people feel comfortable getting the help they need and saying that that's okay.
Yeah,
I think making it personal is so important, and I think that's part of when the woman who edited my book and kind of told me make it your story was kind of getting at, like, when it's my story and I'm saying, you know, I went to get help and this is what it was like for me and this is why it helped me, that makes it a lot, I think, I don't know, it makes it easier for people to hear, like, okay, that's what she did, versus like, everyone should get help who has a mental illness. You know, if you make it more personal or have someone who's willing to be open about it in your ward, like, that can be just being the example. I mean, you think of like Christ, you know, he was the example. And so it's good to be an example to people rather than dictate what they should do.
And what I'm, you know, learning from as you talk about this is, I think a lot of leaders out there, as they listen to this, thinking, okay, we're going to be more open about this. And they sort of feel like they have to find examples within their ward or the people they interact with. But in reality, they can tell other stories like your own. Another shameless plug to check out your book, but to definitely, you know, become familiar with your experience. And then as the bishop or Leaf Society president, present that to your ward and saying, here's one scenario that I've heard about, right? And as people listen to that story, they sort of start to relate and think, oh, wow, you know, this is exactly what I've been waiting to hear. And then they can go to the leader knowing they have a reference point that I know a little bit about something about this.
That is so huge. I mean, and that's really what helped me to realize and accept that I had obsessive compulsive disorder was going to the first psychology appointment I went to wasn't an individual one. It was actually a group therapy session. And hearing those stories of other people and being like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, I do that and I've done that and that and that. And like, I had that reference point now. Like, oh, this is OCD. It's not just anxiety or depression or whatever. Like, yes, I've experienced these stories in my life. So that's huge.
And one thing I'll add is that in a ward, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if almost every other person suffered from at some point in their lives, anxiety, depression, some of these basic, you know, mental health challenges that are so common in our society. And so talking about these things as just part of the, you know, we talk a lot about self-reliance. We talk a lot about, you know,
self-sufficiency,
service and all these things. I think talking about mental health as part of self-reliance, self-sufficiency, some of these basic, how do we take care of ourselves and the people in our community is huge and something we can integrate into any lessons about those topics as well.
Yeah. Love that. Right. So I want to shift gears a little bit here and, you know, Jamin, you talked about early on, you know, before Harry was called as the Relief Society president, that, you know, the bishop asked you, hey, you think she's ready for a big calling, quote unquote, right? And we've talked about the stigma of mental health, but then there's this whole nother layer of like, okay, yeah, let's be open and talk about it, but let's not put these people in positions of influence, right? I mean,
let's not.
Yeah, exactly.
Power,
and so there's almost another layer of stigma of, you know, there's no reason why somebody that's experienced anxiety or depression or, you know, OCD shouldn't be considered as a bishop or at least society president, right? And because it's not like their life is constantly out of control. Now, obviously, there's some conditions that, you know, this is their, you know, their cross in life that they're bearing and have an intense mental illness that takes constant medical attention and so forth.
Right.
But how do we as a bishop or as a, you know, leader, specifically in a bishopric who's, you know, considering callings and, you know, wanting to call these people who seem very capable, what should we consider as we're considering them for these callings?
I'll give some feedback there is I think we need to really sit down and talk with them and listen to them. And one of the things that I think they might say is, I can definitely do this, but it's not going to be the way that someone else would have done the same thing. You know, Carrie isn't the same Relief Society president as another Relief Society president. Sometimes she needs to take time for her mental health, which means maybe weeks where she's really not able to do the visits or some of the extraneous activities required of a Relief Society president. And so there might be additional delegation. There might be additional help needed in terms of counselors or other assistance to the person in that calling that could help them if they are having some challenges. When Carrie was called to Relief Society president, she was doing fantastic. And as we mentioned earlier in the recording, a few months, maybe 6 months after that, she had hit another really big low point. And there was a few months, about 3 months, where it was really difficult.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, I was helping out a lot more around the house. And, you know, she was really thinking, I don't know if I can go forward with this calling. You know, it's just a lot to add to the difficulty, you know, that she's already facing. And so it really might mean having a little bit more you know, consideration and compassion around, okay, this might look a little non-traditional once in a while, and that's okay. And if you feel inspired to call someone, let them know that it's going to be done in their way and that the Lord has called them and trust them. And that might, you know, that might mean a little more flexibility, or it might look a little differently than what people are expecting.
Exactly. I think it's exactly what Jamin was saying, that, yeah, it's, we're each going to be doing our calling in a different way, whether or not we have a mental illness or not, right? We're all individuals. And I think the Lord planned for that, and he wants that. When I very soon had the impression or the realization that I was called to be Relief Society president because of my mental illness, and not in spite of it, but because I had that empathy and I had those, that experience in dealing with that and in, you know, going to therapy and yeah, fighting that stigma, because our ward, and I'm sure many wards, have a lot of women and men who have mental illness and who feel that stigma and don't know what to do or don't know what care to get.
Hidden, you know, it's often hidden. Right. And having people in leadership that have experienced this is a huge blessing for them, because right. they're able to talk to someone and feel like they can relate to people,
yeah.
whereas maybe they couldn't have done that before.
Right. It gives people, you know, this extra empathy, just like how we love the Savior and he's, you know, we consider him so the Savior because he has that empathy and has felt all that we felt and can understand all that we've been through. You know, that's why we love the Savior so much, I think. And so as leaders, as we go through these challenges, it's not like something we should be ashamed of, but something that allows us to become more like the Savior, because we can experience, we've experienced some of these low points that people experience so frequently, but don't talk about. And so in a way, we are helping the Savior in his mission, I think, to really love those and carry their burdens and understand their burdens.
Yeah. So Carrie, as you've gone through this time as leading as Relief Society president, and maybe even as your time as primary president, can you give us any examples of how you've sort of seen your OCD creep up, and then you just had to approach things differently or delegate more? Or what did that look like day to day, week to week?
Okay, for primary, that's a good one. I mean, there were so many weeks, and I had little children at the time, like even like newborns, you know, when I was primary president. And so there were times where it was like, I can't, like there would be weeks, I'm like, I think someone's getting sick and I don't want to go to church if anyone's sick, but like, I have to conduct, or I have to, you know, do the sharing time that week. And so it's just the intense stress, and I would just have to go and challenge that obsession and that anxiety and just do it. I would send like letters to inactive children, and I would worry that if I licked the envelope, maybe I was sick, and then I would get them sick. And when they opened it, and so I'd wear like rubber gloves, you know, I wear like plastic gloves to seal the envelope. I mean, it got ridiculous.
That was when it was bad. How did you adjust it to, like, I mean, when you were dealing with this, I mean, outside of just doing it, because obviously like you can't always just like,
yeah, you can't push always just on push through. So I think, I mean, there are times you definitely have to rely on your counselors, rely on other people. And I think just realize, like, you know, while I think I'm so important, like the church is going to keep going, even if I'm not there, or if I need to take some time off, like Relief Society is still going to be like doing their thing and meeting. And you have to put trust in other people, which is difficult sometimes for people with mental illness or with OCD, perfectionism, and this kind of thing. I say, okay, I just have to trust that it's going to work out without me or without my trying to control everything and make sure it's perfect. Like, things don't have to be perfect, and they're never going to be perfect.
I think when Carrie was the primary president, it was sort of this realization. I think you were talking with Sister Wixom that one time, and
who was the general primary president. Her husband was my mission president, and we were living in Utah for some of that time. So yeah, so we're kind of close.
Yeah, I think she said, you know, something like, because Carrie was so stressed out, you know, what should I be worrying about? What should I do? And she's just like, just make sure the kids, what did she say? Do you remember?
Basically, she, you know, just make sure that the kids feel loved, and that even they just learn one thing that Sunday, like that is enough. You know, you don't have to make sure they learn every single point of the lesson, but just that they feel loved and welcome there and learn one thing, one principle.
So it's focusing on the core of like, why are we really doing this? And sort of unraveling the layers of programs and everything, and just focusing on like, what am I really, you know, if there's one thing I had to do, and stripping away so much of the rest and saying, mm-hmm. if I can just do one thing, yeah. what would that one thing be?
Right. So what about, is you're now, you know, you would maybe define yourself a little more stable than in the past, as Relief Society president now, where you're sort of in this more stable stage. Right. What does that look like? Is it all internal, like of you just having these thoughts, or do you have to talk to your bishop and say, hey, when I do this, just be patient. I'm just doing, going through this or that. Or what does that look like?
It's
a constant thing. I mean, because this is my brain and this is how it's working. And so, I'm having to constantly think, okay, well, I shouldn't do this. I should do this, to fight the OCD or to live with it. And so, I mean, can we even going to board council or, this daily today things of, teaching, did I teach the right thing? Or was I offending anyone? Or was I saying the correct doctrinal thing that I should have? And you just kind of have to be like, well, maybe not. Like, maybe I'm going to offend someone.
I
have to live with it.
Terry was clear with the bishop, like, again, after the first few months when she had a really big, difficult time, it was like, look, bishop, this is going to be hard go. Like, we're going to work on this, but it's not going to be always perfect. And, I think just practical things that you've done differently, you've delegated doing visits from time to time when that was really difficult. You've sort of tried to simplify
meetings, kind of cut down on how many meetings we have and how often.
Because ultimately, and for me, I even during this difficult time, I went to the bishop and said, look, with Carrie's calling and Relief Society president, I was in the Elders Quorum presidency. I said, going to several meetings during the week, like we need a little bit, I need to be at home more to help out with the kids while Carrie's, getting better and dealing with her.
Going to therapy
and doing her stuff. Yeah. And it was like, it was weird. I've never, turned down a calling or quit a calling, but I prayed about it and felt like, yeah, I need to support Carrie right now. And so with our situation, I basically said, look, someone else can be a counselor in the Elders Quorum for now. And, Bishop was really supportive and said, I totally understand. I'm glad you're there for her. And, they were able to find another counselor. And then I've been able to step in, and it's not like I'm doing Relief Society work, but I'm hopefully, occasionally going on visits with Carrie or helping her as we go and talk to people or making plans together. Mm-hmm. So that's been a way as a family, we've been able to adjust a little bit to support her doing this calling. And maybe it meant that I had to sacrifice a little bit of doing my calling, but obviously I think in this case, it's what I feel like.
And my mind is going to, what I'm really gathering from all this is when I was in a stake presidency, we called a high counselor who was in his medical residency up at the University of Utah. And when we called him, we knew that he was very busy, and he sort of just told us, listen, I'm in my residency and my schedule's crazy. I really don't have a lot of time. And we assured him that's okay. And we did adjust, we gave him certain responsibilities that he could do, that it wasn't required for him to, be assigned to be a ward rep and these things. And so we just sort of worked with it. And I met with him as a member of state presidency on a monthly basis, give or take. But the point being is that he had situations in his life that we made room for him to serve, even though he was in his medical residency. And we could have easily just said, well, he's just busy and there'll be other time for him to serve. But I think with mental illness, it's sort of the same thing. We can say like, oh, they deal with depression, anxiety. Let's not even consider them. Or we could say, they deal with that, but how can we make room for them? Do they need 5 or 6 counselors? Could they have 4 secretaries? Like, what do we need to do so that they can get that opportunity? Because these opportunities to serve are they're so beneficial to individuals that get these opportunities to really stand in these positions and serve. And so that's sort of what I'm gathering from all this.
Exactly.
I think that's absolutely great. And you don't want the ward or the, especially in a smaller ward, to fall back on a handful of, known people that can lead. It is important to reach out sometimes to people that are unexpected. And of course, the inspiration will come as the leaders try and find out those people. If they look beyond the short
the
list
core
of people that seem to always be in charge.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, and this is another kind of shift to a different topic here. And this is such an important topic that we're going longer and longer, and that's okay with me. People can obviously pause and come back to this, but Jamin, you talked about this term of scrupulosity, and this, I know, regardless if somebody's dealing with OCD or not, Elder Holland talked about in his recent conference talk in October of 2017 about just this idea of, we do have a culture of, God asks us to be therefore perfect. And well, what does that look like day to day, and how do we not beat ourselves up with that? But just realize that, sure, we're not doing enough, and that's okay. And so I know as a bishop many times, you know, anytime anybody came into that office and thought, you know, whether they're struggling with a sin or they are just going through a tough time, it always came back to this idea of, well, you know what? I do need to read my scriptures more. And I do need to just rededicate myself to that weekly temple attendance, and which is important. But when we use it in a way that is the solution, if we just change that, things will fall into place, right? And that sort of plays into this scrupulosity. So maybe define the term. And Carrie, how did it show up in your experience with OCD? And what do we as leaders need to be aware of when it comes to this term?
Well, scrupulosity is basically a religious OCD, where you feel you have these obsessions regarding, you know, sinning, or have I made a mistake? Or sometimes people feel like they have to pray in a certain way or a certain length of time. And so they just feel this constant guilt and shame, and that they must do certain things like confess or repent or, you know, do penance or whatever over and over again. And they still don't feel relief. It's like they feel like the atonement will not work for them, even though they've been trying so hard. And it just must be in their mind because they are a sinner who the atonement can't touch. And I'm sure we see a lot of these people. And for me, that's how the OCD started. When I was finishing up BYU, and OCD a lot of times will latch on to whatever you are concerned about or is a big thing in your life. And so I think for a lot of LDS people, it can take that form of scrupulosity. And it's really hard, I think, for LDS people to recognize that that's what it is, because of this whole perfectionism thing and be therefore perfect. And so I must just not be doing good enough if I feel this. And so I just have to keep trying harder and harder and harder. And there's even conference talks, like there was one, I think, in April of 2017, like, be all in and, you know, do everything you can. And it's like this amplification. We were at the OCD Con conference this last July in San Francisco, and a speaker who wasn't LDS or anything, but she was talking about religious scrupulosity and saying how there's kind of this like amplification with church leaders. I can't remember what she called it, but like youth leader amplification or something, where they kind of say something at 100 volume because most people hear it, especially teenagers in her case, like at 10%, right? And so they're like, okay, well, they're getting something out of my 100% amplification. But for people with mental illness, we hear it at like 1,000%, right?
Yes.
But they're not intending us to hear it that loudly. And so I think that can be a problem with a lot of like general conference talks or these be therefore perfect scripture. Like Christ was talking about, you know, like in eternity, you know, like I'm not perfect until I'm resurrected, kind of an idea is what he was getting at. But we're just like, especially with mental illness, we're like, no, right now, I have to do it. And so it's really damaging. And it's really important to be aware that that is what it is, and that it's not a spiritual problem that you're going through, that it's a mental health concern.
Yeah. And I think the fact that you said that this needs to be emphasized, that it's unintended, it's damaging, but it's unintended, right? And so, because I as leaders are listening, they may think, oh, I have to be, you know, what have I done? You know, but it's not your fault. I mean, you're doing your best. God bless you. You know, you said something. But again, it's that communication, right? That you said one thing, but they interpreted another thing.
Exactly. And I think that happens all the time.
You know, I love that, the analogy of the amplification, because it's like most people, you know, me at church on Sunday, I'm like, you know, I'm about halfway tuned in. And so if someone says, someone almost has to be extra dramatic or really, you know, kind of emphasize the point for me to really listen up. But then for Carrie, at certain times in her life, it was like, you know, listening to it at such a level where everything sort of is so painful to hear. And of course, that's not the speaker's fault, or necessarily, there's not even necessarily anything that can be done. But of course, in the one-on-one sessions, trying to look for these signs or try and, you know, figure out, you know, with Carrie, it's like when she was going back to the bishop to confess things like burning a CD, you know, this is in like the probably early 2000s when that was still a thing, and small things like that over and over again, and just feeling this constant guilt and torment, that might be a time to think, you know what, this may not be a spiritual problem. You know, there's no, you know, you've done all that you can do, literally. I mean, you contacted the recording industry. I mean, at this point, like, and you're still feeling bad about it, or feeling guilt over, you know, all sorts of small, you know, contractual things, feeling like you had to, in her case, She used to read, you know, like the iTunes. You sign up for iTunes, you get like the 42 pages. I mean, she would read every single page for fear that she'd be breaking the law or something like that. That's all part of the scrupulosity of trying to be so morally upright and perfect. And so, you know, it is difficult in the church. You know, I don't know how leaders can determine that. But of course, just keep it in your mind, like, hey, you know what? Just because someone's trying to be perfect, there might be a point where it's not actually a spiritual something wrong spiritually, but it may actually be a mental health thing. Yeah. It's of course a very delicate issue to bring up, but definitely something to be aware of.
Yeah. Cause I think it's important to emphasize what you're saying is that we're not advocating that, hey, the general authorities need to take it down a notch, man. They're to being, you know, they're being too strong, right? Like we're definitely
stop quoting scriptures. No, that's not it.
Yeah. We're not saying, okay, now bishops need to go water down their message, right? Because we do want to set standard and
absolutely
articulate principles, and I want to be part of organizations that when I show up, they're always encouraging me to be more and to overcome some of my weaknesses. Yeah. Right, but I think it's
the gospel is to continually improve ourselves,
absolutely,
and the world around us, and so we do need that challenge. Yeah. But we have to be mindful again. I think when we're especially again on the one-on-one basis, when we see that people that has a damaging effect on them
struggling,
or really struggling with that. I mean, I know especially a lot of women struggle with the perfectionism. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, maybe the message is the same. We definitely need to be thoughtful in how we counsel with these folks and make sure they understand that their best is always enough.
Yeah.
And that but again, if someone has a scrupulosity, they're never going to feel that. And they're always going to feel they don't have that Savior's love is not enough for them. And again, I don't know how that we can sort of identify that because it is very difficult. But I just found this is so interesting as we've learned more about scrupulosity, as we've, you know, gone through Carrie's journey, and just think, you know, I've heard so many people in the church talk about this, feeling like they don't feel like they're ever can be good enough or they can't do all the things they're being asked to do. And I'm thinking, you know what, for me, I haven't had those struggles. But when I hear people saying that, I think, you know what? How can we help these people? What can we do to help them? Because of course we want everyone to feel the Savior's love and feel that compassion. And so we need to make sure that we really find ways to help these people.
Yeah. Love that. Anything else as far as this, you know, religious devotion and scrupulosity goes that maybe we haven't hit on?
Yeah. I mean, I would just say, you know, if people are having a hard time, like I was at that time, finding joy in the gospel, that's when you need to start thinking, okay, what's really going on? Like, is this a spiritual problem or is this a mental health problem? And letting them know there's nothing wrong with them. If, you know, if it's a mental health problem and
bad. Yeah.
It's not bad. I mean, there's something wrong. Like you have a mental health problem, but it's not a sin and it's not something you should be ashamed of or worried about. Some people think like that we shouldn't have, take medication for these kind of problems in the church. And it's just like, no, like you can, like, you know, Elder Holland said that. It's good. but it's like, you know, it's you shouldn't be ashamed of getting help outside of your church leadership, of going to a counselor or a therapist.
Yeah. And on this topic too, we've heard a lot of people talk to Carrie, say, well, look, you know, where can I find an LDS therapist or a Mormon therapist? And, you know, Carrie hasn't ever had an LDS therapist. But all of them have been extremely supportive of her religious devotion and her wanting to be an active member of the church. And so we definitely wouldn't want to, at least in all the people we've talked to, all the leaders that we've seen with regards to anxiety and OCD, they've never wanted to discourage people from being active and faithful in their religious devotion. So I wouldn't shy away from seeking out help from people that maybe aren't LDS. They may be able to help you just as well or better than someone that is. They really aren't there to try and change your religious devotion. And
get a new psychologist.
Get a new psychologist. But that's definitely not the experience you had at all.
Yeah. Right. I think generally speaking, people aren't looking to peg religion as the problem that's causing all this. Right. And so.
Right. If they are properly trained, they will know that that's not the case.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, I definitely want to talk about the conference you have coming up and you're putting together, but is there anything else we've missed in general with this discussion? Obviously, this is a discussion that needs a book, which you've written, and people should go out and get it. And so we can't just cover it in a simple hour-long interview, but is there anything else that we need at least address that we haven't touched on?
Yeah, I think we've done a good job. I guess just the main issue, you know, issues of just making sure people feel loved and that they, you know, it's not their fault that they have these problems and that, you know, God loves them still. always, you know, because of their issues and in spite of them and all the time. And he wants us to get help and he wants us to be happy.
Yeah, I think the idea about getting help is something we've talked about it before, but I mean, I don't want to be too lighthearted. I want to say this delicately, but like when we're broken our leg, or something bad happens, if we have a
cancer,
we may get a blessing, and we may seek out that kind of help, but of course we'll always go to the best doctor or get the best help available to us. And so I think it's important that people that are struggling with these issues with mental health don't feel in any way ashamed or bad about going to reach out for the best help. And I can see leaders being very open about, hey, I had some trouble with depression and I went to talk to my doctor about it and was able to get some medication to help me with that. I mean, if people are open about that stuff, because we know that many LDS people are doing these things, but I think in many cases, it's sort of something that's a shameful secret. You know, yes, many LDS people may use medication for depression, but we don't talk about it. We're not open with it. And I think that creates a bit of a shame culture that we need to get away from. We need to be comfortable with talking about these things. And I think we can do that again if leaders are talk about what they're doing, even if it's not mental health related, but again, hey, I had to go to the doctor for this. I mean, not that they're sharing all their personal private matters, but just being comfortable saying, you know, yes, I got a blessing, but I'm also seeking help from a doctor. And, you know, if you're having these problems, you can too. I think that's okay.
Yeah. And I want to echo that too. You know, if there's a leader out there, you know, we've already received the direction to be therefore perfect. But then when I'm the bishop or the recite president, not only do I have to be perfect, but I have to do it in style or something, you know, that it's okay if that, because obviously when you get these, there may be somebody that experiences OCD or anxiety or whatever, but suddenly you're putting this calling and those dials are turned up, right? And then it's to a point that I was able to manage my life now, but now it is off the charts and I don't know what to do because the bishop is supposed to have his life together, you know, you know, but to be open to that and say, even you can have a broken leg or anxiety or, you know, those things. So such an important message.
Exactly. Yeah. Like high stress situations can amplify, like you said, those mental illnesses, but like missions, especially.
Too, missions are a huge one.
You have a whole nother. So yeah, just be aware of that. And yeah, don't be ashamed. And if you need to take a break. It's like you have a baby, you stay home from church for a couple Sundays, you know, and no one thinks like that's a bad thing.
I think, you know, that's a good point. It's just being comfortable if people feel like they need to take some time, not that they're quitting church or anything, but just saying, hey, you know, I'm not able to perform my calling for a while I'm getting treatment for this or getting help with this, or, you know, sometimes going at a lower speed is definitely something that we need to encourage if it helps people. We don't want people to burn out. You know, they're working their very hardest, but then they just can't do it anymore. I think we'd rather have people in for the long haul. So sometimes that means, you know, taking it a little bit easier while they're getting on their feet.
Yeah, I love that. Even just giving them a break without feeling like you have to release them, right? And make a big deal about it. Give them some weeks apart from the responsibilities, and realize they have counselors or others that can step in. But sometimes releasing them will sort of be like, well, I guess you failed here. And then it will almost just add to it, right? So
Yeah, exactly.
Well, tell us about this, the conference you're putting together. Is this something that is your baby? Like you've
it is. Right yet? It's our third baby. No, it definitely is. We decided, you know, after my book came out, just thought, you know, this would be such a great topic for a conference to discuss more as we're doing now. And so we decided to plan and organize a conference called Anxiety Disorders and Mormonism. And we started a company called Mental Illness Matters to kind of, you know, to plan all of that and to have that. So you can definitely visit that website for more information about that and other conferences that we plan to do.
We've got so far some fantastic speakers. This is not happening until March of 2018, but we've got Leaders in Scrupulosity, John Hirschfield, who's written books and other things on that, and Reed Wilson, who's a fantastic anxiety expert. He's written like 17 books or something.
Maybe not that many.
And he's a fantastic speaker as well as, you know, so those are sort of non-Mormon therapists. And then we also have Julie Hanks from Utah, who's a well-known therapist in Utah. And then we're working now on reaching out to LDS leaders or therapists or people working with Mormon people that have experiences working with people with anxiety.
Bishops and stake leaders.
Yeah, any leaders. We'd love to have them participate in both attending the conference, hopefully learning how to better help people like this, and also sharing their experiences. If you've been a mission president and you helped missionaries that were going through difficult anxiety, or if you've you know, we'd love to have people sharing these stories of how they've been able to help other people through these situations, because we know so many people are going through these problems, and we just want to, I don't know, raise awareness and, mm-hmm. and get more people talking about it. That was the whole idea behind this conference.
Hopefully decrease that stigma that we were talking about. If, you know, we don't talk about this. Like, no, we're going to talk about this. We're going to have a big party about it.
We're not going to stop talking about it.
So yeah, that's March 3rd. It's a Saturday of 2018 at the Joseph Smith Memorial Building. And early bird tickets are available right now.
Yeah, available now. And, you know, we're also accepting if people have ideas for things they'd want to share to speak, or panelists, if they want to be on a panel, if they have a mental illness, especially anxiety disorder, PTSD as well, some of these other related disorders, if they'd like to speak about their experiences and how they've been able to get through that and continue to serve and participate in the church, we'd love to hear from them.
Awesome. Well, Carrie, I want to give you the final word here. What final encouragement do you have for bishops, Relief Society presidents, leaders out there that are striving to make their local ward a welcoming place and remove the stigma of mental illness?
Oh, thanks. I just think that it's so important to be open and loving and compassionate for everyone in your ward and that you lead, because we do not know what people are going through. And it's, mental illness is so common, and yet most people don't bring it up and don't talk about it and don't admit that they have it. So it's something that we need to treat with so much care and love, and let people know that they're not alone, and that help and hope are possible, and that we need to be, as leaders, the examples of compassion and of helping people to get the help that they need so that they can live the life that they want to live. And it's totally possible to manage living with a mental illness. It's not always easy. It's not like a one-time solution or, you know, miraculous cure, but that's okay. And that's, you know, we can learn to be greater disciples of Christ as we help those who are dealing with mental illness, and even as we deal with mental illness as individuals.
Big thank you to Jamin and Carrie. What a fantastic, fun couple. I consider them friends now, and I'm looking forward to their conference, and I hope I'll be able to participate in some degree there, because such an important topic and an important conference to put together, and I want to promote that. What I want you to do at this point, if you are interested in more information about mental illness and serving in leadership, I want you to go over to leadinglds.org and submit your email there. And by submitting your email, we're going to be sending out updates to their conference, resources, and such. And by being on our email list, that makes sure that you don't miss any of those updates. So really important part of being in the Leading LDS community is being on that email list and receiving those updates. I sure appreciate everybody that is out there that's listening. You know, I get your emails, I hear from you, I get your encouragement, and it is definitely encouraging. I hope this is making a difference. And we at Leading LDS, we're giving everything we got to continue to put out rich resources that are going to assist you in enhancing your ability and capacity as lay leaders. Now, these episodes don't just magically come together. There's a lot of people in the mix helping out with this. I want to thank Nathan Waldron for all his good work he does as our podcast producer. Sam Allen, who's tirelessly working with the administration of Leading LDS. And a few more individuals that make this happen: Haley Frankham, Buster Summerhays, Angie Haney, Brandon Levitt, Jen Maybe, Rich and Jones, Dave Harris. You guys, I couldn't do this out without you, and I want to give you a shout out to recognize that you're doing good work. And for all you leaders out there, let's keep this going. Head on over to leadinglds.org and become part of the Leading LDS community by being a core leader. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the own and only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.